Welcome to Two Way Street. The news this weekend has been filled with stories about the 50th anniversary of one of the most violent episodes in the American civil rights movement. On March 7, 1965, 600 voting rights advocates set out to march from Selma, Alabama, to the state capitol in Montgomery. The first steps in their journey were to take them across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. John Lewis and Hosea Williams led the marchers, and so they were among the first to see the dozens of Alabama state troopers on foot and horseback, wearing gas masks and riot gear, were positioned to block the movement of the marchers.
It'll be detrimental to your safety to continue this march, and I'm saying that this is an unlawful assembly. You are ordered to disperse, go home, or go to your church. This march will not continue.
The troopers moved in, flinging tear gas canisters, swinging billy clubs, and beating protesters in their path. Martin Luther King Jr. wasn't in Selma that day. The march hadn't been scheduled to take place on March 7th, but demonstrators had shown up anyway, and they were determined to proceed. And so Andy Young, who was one of King's chief lieutenants, was rushed from Atlanta to Selma to oversee events as they unfolded. In a conversation with Two Way Street recently, Young recalled the violence he watched.
My job was always to stay cool. And I really wasn't up there. I didn't cross the bridge. I was at the back of the line.
The Edmund Pettus Bridge.
Edmund Pettus Bridge.
Yeah.
When people started running back and the horses and tear gas. So we started ushering people back toward the church.
News film from Selma shocked the nation and woke Americans outside the South to the brutal realities of how far white Southerners were prepared to go to defend their way of life.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. President, members of the Congress, I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
President Johnson expressed his outrage by immediately petitioning Congress to pass a Voting Rights Act. He made his plea in a historic address before a joint session of Congress on March 15, 1965.
What happened in Selma is part of a far larger movement which reaches into every section and state of America. It is the effort of American Negroes to secure for themselves the full blessings of American life. Their cause must be our cause too, because it's not just Negroes, but really it's all of us who must overcome the crippling legacy of bigotry and injustice. And we shall overcome.
A week after that speech, on March 21st, 8,000 women, men, and children, black and white, protected by federal troops, finally crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge and began their march to Montgomery. Led by Dr. King, they arrived at the state capitol on March 25th, and there Dr. King answered a question that was certainly on the minds of many of the 25,000 people who had come to support the voting rights campaign. How long would black citizens have to wait for full rights as Americans?
How long? Not long.
How long?
Because you shall reap what you sow.
Yes, sir.
How long? Not long.
How long?
Truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne.
Yes, sir.
Yet that scaffold sways the future.
Yes.
Behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. How long? Not long. Because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice.
Yes, sir.
How long?
Not long.
Because mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Yes,
he's trampling out the biggest.
5 months later, President Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act into law. Among the hundreds of dignitaries who filled the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol for the signing was Rosa Parks. She was there because her courageous act of protest, undertaken alone, with no crowds to buoy her, inspired much of what happened in Alabama over the decades of the civil rights struggle. Rosa Parks' moment came on December 1, 1955. The 43-year-old secretary for the local chapter of the NAACP refused to give up her seat on a city bus in Montgomery for a white passenger. Her arrest led to the Montgomery bus boycott. For 381 days, blacks refused to ride the bus until the segregated seating rules were overturned. Few of us know much about the rest of Rosa Parks' life. For us, she's remained a distant symbol of quiet courage and grace in the face of bigotry and hatred. But now, thanks to the book Our Auntie Rosa, written by her niece, Sheila McCauley Keyes, we've been given the opportunity to see Parks the way her family saw her, a devoted aunt who cherished family above all else, a woman who believed in justice but forgiveness as well. Keyes is one of 13 children of Parks' brother, Sylvester. She called upon each of her siblings to contribute their stories about their famous aunt. And so what we get is a rare intimate glimpse at a civil rights icon made human. Sheila McCauley Keyes, so nice to have you here for Two-Way Street. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So let's talk about your relationship. Even though the book tells the relationships of all of your siblings and more, let's talk about your relationship with Auntie Rosa. And let's start by saying, after she left Montgomery, after she was arrested for her act of civil disobedience, sitting where she was not supposed to sit, refusing to give up a seat on the bus, she couldn't stay in Montgomery because no one would hire her, correct?
Yeah, she had problems getting work. There were death threats to my grandmother and my uncle, and mainly her. And my father would plead with them to come up north, come to Detroit. There's work here. You can find a job. But no, the South was home. And people, even though it was not the best of times, it took her 2 years to decide, hey, we've got to leave here.
Your father was Sylvester.
Yes.
He was Rosa Parks' brother, which is what she called him, brother.
Correct.
And so he had moved to Detroit, and you and your siblings were all raised in Detroit.
Correct.
So Rosa Parks eventually moved to Detroit after that two-year period of trying to decide to do it, and she came to live initially with the family, right?
Correct. When she moved to our home on Deacon Street in Detroit, that was 1957, I wasn't born. So I relied on my other siblings, and that's what's so great about having many siblings. We, our ages vary. My sisters that are 10, 12 years older than me could tell me these stories I needed to know in order to put the book together. I had no idea what happened, but they came to me with their information. This is what I love about a big family. And so I got all the information from them when they arrived at Deacon Street. And she, my sister Deborah, recalled when they came in the front door of our home, the hugs, the tears, because my father was so, he wanted them here because he felt they would be safer in the Detroit area rather than in Alabama. So when my sister told when they came in the door and they were small, looking up at them, and I, oh, wow. They all look alike, which we do.
What's interesting is that your older brothers and sisters who were there when she came really didn't necessarily have any idea why she was so famous or that she was famous at all.
They did not know. They knew that was their Auntie Rosa. That's what they knew. They didn't know either until, I guess, going through school. And then, you know, then they found out about her, but she never came in the door and said, you know, hi, I'm Rosa Parks, the one that sat on the bus. They were all little kids, and they were just hugging her. They didn't know, you know, anything about that. It was just family.
By the time you came along, Rosa Parks and her husband, who was called Parks, had moved into their own home, but you were all still very, very close. So do you remember how old you were when you yourself first learned about the fact that your Auntie Rosa was an iconic figure?
I believe I was in the fourth grade in elementary school when I found out about this woman that had sat down on the bus. I'm looking at the picture. This is my Auntie Rosa. And, of course, the other children in school did not believe me. This is my aunt. I'm telling them, this is my aunt. They did not believe that that was my aunt. And I was like, wow, that's her. Auntie Rosa is Rosa Parks. We didn't, I don't even think I knew what her last name was.
Wow.
And so, just Auntie Rosa.
Do you, you said you saw her picture.
In a school book. And so you ran home, Ma, you know, ask your mother, ask your father. They're like, yeah, okay. This is true. Okay, now go and go outside and do whatever you have to do. Go play. That's it. They never say, yeah, that's her, and we're going to shine a light over and put her on a pedestal. She never wanted that. She was just our auntie when she came over.
She was a very modest and unassuming woman. And there's a quote that you highlight in the book in which you quote her as saying, don't make a fuss about me. I'm just your auntie.
Yeah.
That was really her, yes?
Yeah, because she didn't like that that fussiness over her. And even when, this is kind of sad, but even when she was about to, it was a few years before she passed, she told my sister, I don't want people gawking at me. I don't want a fuss made over me when I die.
You piece together the story. You tell the story of that day. It was December 1st, 1955.
Mm-hmm.
She got on the bus in Montgomery. And the way in which you tell the story, I must say, it teaches me something that I didn't really understand about what your aunt, Auntie Rosa, really did. The conventional thought was that she refused to give up her seat to a white person.
Mm-hmm.
But the story as you tell it in the book is a little different than that. That, if I understand this right, that she was sitting in the front of the, what was then called the colored section
colored
of the
section,
bus.
Right.
And a white man came and sat in the last row of the seats in the white section of the bus.
I believe she was too close to him.
That was,
and they wanted her to move so that she wouldn't be close to the white passenger.
Yeah, apparently, according to the arcane rules of segregation,
Jim Crow,
if a black person would have to move at least one row back to leave more space.
Right.
So what she really did was not surrender her seat, as many people think, to a white person, but she refused to move back to make that space that
right,
was by
to make the, so that the rule, the Jim Crow rule, would be in effect. She refused to. She's just a why, you know, and I think that she was just certainly tired of being bullied by that system of things, by Jim Crow. She was tired of that. I don't think she was tired, like, or her feet hurt, or I'm so tired from work. She was just tired of being bullied, period, you know, by the Jim Crow.
I just wonder if when you were young and first heard this story, you found it hard to imagine the Jim Crow laws that your auntie and Uncle Parks grew up dealing with.
Yeah, I did find that really, really hard to fathom that this is what people did to other people, and these were Christian people. That will be the first thing you learn, is to treat people the way you want to be treated. Get that one rule. Get that down, that golden rule.
To go back to that day,
mm-hmm.
your auntie told at least one of your siblings that the white bus driver that day had it in for her, that they'd mm-hmm. had incidents in the past, that the way that the system worked is that a black person would get on in the front of the bus, pay his or her fare,
great,
get off, and then enter on the rear. And that this bus driver had on occasion taken her fare, she'd stepped off, and then pulled away. He had apparently seen her in her involvement with an NAACP
yes.
event or something, so he had it in for her.
And she was a troublemaker, and she's stirring things up, you know, getting people thinking. So that's what I was alluding to when you would pay, and then
and
this guy was actually, he spotted her. And he knew her face. And so he would do mean things to her. You know, pay my money and then you get off and run around to the back. Something had to be done about that.
One of the things that you talk about, and it's an apropos time to bring it up because of this bus driver. Mm-hmm. You say that she got a lot of hate mail, even in her later life. And she kept all of it. Mm-hmm. And your family had a little bit of difficulty understanding why she would keep it. But do you mind if we read one of the,
okay,
an example of that? And do you mind if I read it?
Yes.
Or would you like to?
You could go ahead.
All right. So here's an example. She went to work later in her career for John Conyers, the congressman,
correct,
from Detroit.
Yes.
And when news of her going to work for him came out, she got this letter, which was sent to her was written on May 19th, 1969.
Mm-hmm.
"We don't think John Conyers should be hiring a person of your low caliber, Rosa, to work in his office, maybe in his private home, for the purpose of scrubbing floors as a domestic maid, perhaps, but certainly not doing office work. You are far too much of a troublemaker and rabble-rouser. We cannot so soon forget all the chaos you made about going to the back of the bus. As a matter of fact, you are to blame, gal, for the current revolution going on among, and excuse my language, the niggers and whites today." And I use that word because it expresses the hate so vividly.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine how it must have made her feel to get a letter like that?
And it was 1969. And for people to still have that hatred inside of them from forever until 1969, when she, you know, maybe that's why she told me, she said, "We've made progress, but we have so much more to do." Because I was thinking, I didn't know about those letters. So I'm thinking, you know, "Oh, we're doing great, Auntie." She's like, "Oh, we have a lot more to do." But she had those letters. She knew about that.
And yet she told you and your siblings not to hate white people, that not all white people are bad.
Right.
And at least some of your siblings had a hard time imagining that white people aren't bad, given things like that.
Yeah, yeah. My one sister, Deb, she was a little kid. And I think it was Emmett Till they had found his body.
Yeah.
And she was so hurt and scared. And usually the little kids weren't around when adults were speaking about these things. But she was eavesdropping and she heard it. And she started crying. She was scared. But Auntie Rosa told her, "Oh, no, no, no." She told her, "All white people aren't bad." Because she didn't want us to go through life hating. Because then we would become like the people that created these Jim Crow laws. We would be them. She didn't want us to do that. She wanted us to be better. And so that was, I think, a great story in our Auntie Rosa.
Another story in the book about haters is the story about her relationship with George Wallace, the arch segregationist of Alabama, as governor of Alabama. Mm-hmm. And we know the many stories of his hatred for black people and the way in which he blocked progress for blacks,
yes,
in his state for years. Late in his life, after he'd been shot and paralyzed, he had a change of heart, apparently, and apologized for his actions, including apologizing to your Auntie Rosa.
Mm-hmm.
But you have a story in the book about one way in which he tries to apologize and she says, "Enough already." Tell us that.
he wanted to. Oh, he apologized and everything, but he wanted to embrace her and kiss her cheek. And she said, "No." She turned her head because she did not want him to kiss her. And I think that my aunt was a modest woman, and also she did not want him to kiss her.
Yeah, forgiveness has its limits.
She did. She remembered all the things that he had done. And, you know, she's a good person in heart, but sometimes you just have to put a limit on it, like as far as, okay, you can shake my hand. Don't touch. No hugs. No kisses, please. So she turned her head. I thought that was, she said, "Oh, no." She told my sister, I wouldn't let him kiss me. Oh, no.
I'm talking with Sheila McCauley-Keyes. Her book, Our Auntie Rosa, gives readers an intimate look at Rosa Parks, one of the great symbols of the fight for justice and equality. More with Keyes in a moment. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. I'm talking with Sheila McCauley-Keyes. She's a niece of civil rights icon Rosa Parks and has now written Our Auntie Rosa, a warm and moving account of growing up under the tutelage of her famous aunt in Detroit. Those of us who never knew her the way you, of course, did, who just saw her footage on news programs and photographs, nevertheless, couldn't help but see what a absolutely beautiful and transcendent woman she seemed to be. Just her physical presence, her smile, her stature, her poise, the way she dressed. There are some moments in the book that are so interesting just in terms of who she was as a physical being. There's a beautiful photograph of her with her hair down as she's getting ready for bed. We always see her, see the pictures of her with her hair very tightly tied close to her head. That's a beautiful photograph, and it shows us her vulnerability and her beauty in a whole different way.
Yeah, that's how we remember her, is like that. We remember her that way. That's the way we saw her. We saw her with her gown, with her hair down, which she never wore down in public. She was modest. She was a lady, and it was always up in public. When she was home getting ready for bed, she would let us brush her hair, comb her hair, and it was way down her back. It was very long.
It's your favorite picture,
did
you say?
It is my favorite, absolute favorite picture, because that's our Auntie Rosa. And then that was the, I wanted that on the cover. They said no. They said no, but I just thought, that's her. You know, and so let's use that. And they were like,
There's other stories in the book that talk about who she was. Again, as a kind of a physical person, there are some terrific stories about the way she and Parks always dressed. Talk about that.
Yeah, they always dressed with, even if it was really, really warm, suits. Auntie Rosa wore dresses. She did not. She wore the hose. She did not wear pants. She always, usually she would have gloves, little like lace collars. She'd have a handkerchief, a hat. She was just a Southern lady, like just a elegant lady.
There's a marvelous story about her taking the family on a trip to Boblo Island, an amusement park in the Detroit River.
Yeah.
And the way she dressed for that.
It is really something. I don't know. She never seemed to get hot. She stayed cool all the time. And we had our little sleeveless shirts. And she had clothes down. I mean, long sleeves. It was 90 degrees. Long sleeves. She had a shirt, butt collar button up to her neck. She had a hat on. I was like, oh my goodness. But she knew something, because we were all sunburnt by the end of the day. And she wasn't. She was telling us to put aloe vera on that because we were burnt like lobsters by the end of our trip. And she was like, okay, I'm going to fix dinner now. And we were all like, I was for sure. I was like, Auntie Rosa, I need something because I was burnt. And I guess the lesson is she knew what she was doing, that some was there. You need to cover up or you're going to burn. Who? None of us listened. We all fried that day. It was so much fun, though.
There's another thing that your book has in it, and that's some of your Auntie Rosa's recipes.
Oh, yes.
Was she a good cook?
Yes, she was. She's a good cook. My grandmother, they were good cooks, Southern ladies. For some reason, they knew how to cook. They just had it. I don't think they measured much. They did things to taste, smell. They used all their senses. Everything smells so good coming out of that kitchen. I just love going over there on Sundays and, you know, trying to peep around the corners. They wouldn't let us kids in the kitchen when they were cooking. They said, we didn't want you underfoot because you might get burnt on the stove.
They didn't want you to know their recipes. Yeah, that's what it was really about.
And they never wrote anything down. You had to peep. You had to spy. You had to find out how were they doing this? How are they making the magic? How are they making this taste like this?
One of your siblings, I think it was, I don't think it was you, talked about the chicken and dumplings that Auntie Rosa made.
Yes.
And you have that recipe in the book. You remember her chicken and dumplings?
Yes, my sister Deborah. She was the one. She said, oh, they would peep around the corners and spy and see how they were doing things. And my grandmother and Auntie Rosa in the kitchen with their aprons. My grandmother would sing A Closer Walk with Thee all while she's cooking. Low, you could barely hear it. But my sister Deborah, she said, I remember it like it was yesterday. That is the wonderful thing I'm telling you about having a large family. Yeah. You can go back and get those memories through your siblings.
In 1994, an intruder broke into her house. What happened?
Oh, my goodness. This fellow broke into her house. I believe he knocked on the door with the guise of he needed money or something. And she turned to get her purse to give him money because you would treat your fellow man the way you want to be treated. Somebody asked for help, you give it. And that's how she was raised. So she turned to give it to him. And he said, aren't you Rosa Parks? I think she had handed him money. And she said, why, yes. And he said, well, this is not enough. And he hit her. He hit her in her face. And she said she had never been hit that hard by anyone ever in her life. And it was such a terrible thing for this person to do. He took whatever she had in her purse and he ran off. But the whole community found him. They band together and found this fellow that had robbed her because the community wasn't having anybody robbing Mother Parks, as they called her. But she forgave this person. Almost immediately, she forgave him.
The incident, of course, made world headlines.
Yes.
Here was this woman of peace, and she's robbed and struck, and the robber realizes who she is and still goes ahead and hits her. His name was Joseph. I don't know his last name.
Skipper, I believe it was Skipper.
Okay. He, when your aunt died, he wrote that he cried. Mm-hmm. He said, I will go down in history as the man who hit Rosa Parks. I am sorry she died. I was hoping to get out in time to tell her I was sorry. And in the book, you say that she'd already forgiven him.
Oh, yes. That is the type of person she was. That forgiveness was for her to go on and continue to do the work that she needed to do. She just said, this person needs help, and I hope that he gets it. But she forgave him.
On a lighter note, in her later years, she became a practitioner of yoga. I never knew that about Rosa Parks until I read the book.
Yeah, she started doing yoga in her 70s. In her 70s, and she was she was starting to have heart problems, and yoga is about breath. So she took up yoga, started practicing, and I was like, wow, she actually inspired me to do yoga. Because what would I want to do yoga for? I thought, well, Auntie Rose is doing it. But she did inspire me to do that. And that did help her. She also became a vegetarian. She did several things to combat her heart issues. And that was one of them. And I was like, I can't believe Auntie Rose is doing yoga.
Sheila, as much as I love the photograph in the book of Rosa Parks with her long hair down as she's preparing for bed, I would have given anything to see in a picture of her in her yoga pants.
Yeah, she did have she did wear the outfit. I said, oh, no, I would never. She wore the tights and the like a leotard because her collection is at the Library of Congress, and I believe that is one of the photos that they have of her.
In, was it 2013?
Yeah.
You had a remarkable experience in Washington, D.C.
Oh, yeah. I forgot, see, when you said that. Yeah.
What happened?
The unveiling of the statue. Now, that was quite an experience. It was such a proud day for our entire family.
So the statue is in Statuary Hall in the United States Capitol.
Yes. I believe she's the only black woman there next to all the presidents. And I think there's another woman there. Couldn't remember. But I know that she's the only black woman there. And it was a great day.
Yeah, what was that day like for you?
Oh, it was a whirlwind. It was wonderful. Meeting the president, meeting Miss Pelosi. I think I met Boehner. I just met so many people that day. It was really crazy. I met the sculptor, Eugene Daub. He's wonderful, wonderful man. And it was just a nice day. And my whole family was so happy. You know, it was really a nice day.
So let me just, as we close, ask you a little bit about your life as you reflect on having known her. So at one point in an interview, she was interviewed at one point by Judith Martin, who became Miss Manners in the Washington Post.
Mm-hmm.
She said to Judith Martin, "It seems to me it's natural to want to be treated like a human being," which in and of itself is such a simple statement and seems so completely logical. And yet there's a profundity to the simplicity of it. And she also said at another point, "We are not in a struggle of black against white, mm-hmm. but wrong against right."
Mm-hmm.
When you think about this woman saying things like that, what has it meant to you to have grown up? How has it shaped your life to have known Auntie Rosa?
Just to treat people the way you want to be treated, that statement about it being natural to want to be treated like a human being and not an animal, that's it. In a nutshell, there is nothing else. Nobody wants to be beaten. Nobody wants to be made to go to a back of a bus. Nobody wants to be treated like a second-class citizen. And she, it's just, if you're God-fearing, which she was, a spiritual person, this should be natural to you. You should know this. You should be raised in faith. People, you should know these things. I don't understand why people do not, but I know she did tell me that you're responsible for your own actions and you can't make people change. You can only change yourself. So, and that's when change begins, when you change you. So I think that was an important lesson that she did teach us, is that working on yourself then comes, other change comes naturally after you work on you first.
Are you a different person having grown up knowing her than you think you might have been had she not been in your life?
I think so. I think I'm family oriented. I like having my family around me. So did she. I mean, she introduced me to my family I didn't even know existed. She introduced our family to all of our cousins. We didn't even know they were there. My auntie, she was family driven. And so that has trickled down to me. I love my family and I include them in everything. That's why
including
I
your
wanted
book.
An Our Auntie Rosa. They had to be there because they were contributors. They had memories just like I did, and it would have been selfish of me to say, well, I'll have all the memories when I know that I didn't. So I have to include my family in everything that I do. And I think I did get that from her.
Sheila McCauley-Keyes, it's such a pleasure to have you here. Your Auntie Rosa continues to mean, even after her death, so much to all of us who think about those who have the courage to stand up against something that's wrong. Thanks for coming in and talking about your book.
And thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Sheila McCauley-Keyes is the author of Our Auntie Rosa, a book that gives readers an intimate look at the personal side of the woman who fought for justice and equality by refusing to give up her seat on a Montgomery City bus in 1955. Two-Way Street continues in a moment.
We shall not be moved. We shall not be moved like a tree that's planted by the water. We shall not be moved.
Welcome back to Two-Way Street. The civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s played out on a world stage. Dr. King's nonviolent philosophy led to dramatic confrontations that grabbed headlines because they exposed the hatred that some in power had for blacks. Efforts to establish equality for American women throughout the 20th century often relied on quieter, incremental change. And it is those more subtle changes that are woven through the narrative in Anita Diamond's new novel, The Boston Girl. Diamond is the author of the international bestseller, The Red Tent, a book that also focused on the lives of women, in that case, built around a minor character in the Hebrew Bible. The Boston Girl begins in 1915 and takes us through the 1980s. Anita Diamond, thank you for being here for Two-Way Street. It's really great to have you here.
It's delightful to be here.
The new book, The Boston Girl, tells a story about a woman whose life we get to watch from 1915 onward. Mm-hmm. And we get to watch her as she goes through the kind of changes that were happening to many women and to communities in Boston at that point. Is that a fair, brief description?
Absolutely. That's very well done.
Okay.
The story is told by Addie Baum, who is born in the United States in 1900, but we catch up with her at the age of 15 or so. And she's telling the story to her granddaughter, who has asked her this wonderful question, what made you the woman you are today? She's telling the story in 1985 and looking back. And so it's sort of a coming-of-age story. You hear a little bit about her childhood, but it really starts when she starts to wake up to the world as an individual and starting to differentiate herself from her family, who are immigrants to the United States. She's born in the United States, the only person in her family to be born in the U.S. Her family came from Russia at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th. And so there's a big disjuncture between her and the rest of her family.
She's telling her granddaughter about how women have grown and changed over the decades, isn't she?
She is, although she is telling her own story. I mean, the point of the book is not to be a history lesson on women's history. It's to talk about how an individual lived through this tremendous time of change and how it might have affected one individual person. I think what you get from the book is this real warmth between Addie and the person who's listening, her granddaughter. So she can be warmer and more confessional a little bit in a way that I don't think she would with it if she was just talking to the to a stranger.
She does, though, at one point say, "Don't let anybody tell you things aren't better today than they were."
You know, people are always talking about the good old days, yeah. And if you're in your 80s and your friends are always talking about the good old days, Addie would put her hands on her hips and say, "Don't tell me that. I'm remembering before penicillin. I'm remembering when women were not allowed to vote. I'm remembering when women who had been married could not teach school anymore, public school." So Addie has a good, strong sense of the progress that has been made in her own lifetime, for her own personal lifetime, but also all around her. So
it starts as an immigrant story.
Yes.
As you said, she's the only member of her family born in the United States, born in Boston. Mm-hmm. Her family speaks Yiddish mm-hmm. at home, and her mother has no patience for a young girl who wants to be in the world because she herself is an old world woman. Right. Yes?
Yes, absolutely. And while this is very much a Jewish story, it's a story that resonates for people from all different kinds of backgrounds. And I've gotten wonderful emails from people from very different backgrounds, from Italian and Irish, and also someone from the Midwest who was remembering her Scandinavian grandmother talking about the tension between an old world woman usually and her daughters, because as much as they wanted to come to America for a better opportunity for their families, America really seduced girls out of the old ways of doing things, not in the ways that we would consider perfectly normal, like going to school, like finishing high school would be considered for Addie's mother. It's like, you can read, you can do accounts, you're finished. What more do you need?
She's worried that if her daughter reads too much, she is going to begin to squint. And as she tells Addie, men do not like a girl who squints.
Right. And actually, somebody emailed me and said, I heard the very same thing from my grandmother, that too much reading is not good for you. Too much education, no one will want to marry you, no man wants his wife to be smarter than you. And although that sounds very old-fashioned, there are still immigrants coming to the United States every day, and these battles are being fought in all kinds of households and all kinds of communities to this day. And there's a little back and forth. Parents do want their daughters educated, but they don't want them to stray too far from traditional ways of being in a family, being related, and being responsible to family. So that tension is a real all-American story, I think.
I think it's interesting that you described it as an all-American story. Mm-hmm. When, as you point out, this is a melting pot story. Mm-hmm. Addie goes off to the Rockport Lodge. This is the place where she learns the world is bigger than the tenement mm-hmm. community that she lives in. What is the Rockport Lodge?
Well, that's actually where the book started. I found this place. I like to vacation. Rockport is a real place north of Boston. And there was looked like a regular inn called Rockport Lodge. And then I found out that it was, in fact, founded in 1906. And it was women only. It was women only until it closed in the late 80s, early 90s. And it was started as a kind of fresh air fund camps or lodge for young girls in girls' clubs. And also, in the case of Addie, for girls who were involved in settlement house clubs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she was part of a
settlement house. Where mm-hmm. she sort of meets her first mentor, who recognizes a kind of intelligence and spark in Addie and encourages her, among other things, to go to Rockport Lodge, helps her get enough money to get up there, $5 a week for everything, 3 meals a day, horseback riding, sailing, all sorts of things. And Addie sleeps in a bed for the first time by herself.
At that point, Addie is
15, about to be 16.
She does something very bold for a girl, especially with possessive parents. She goes to Rockport Lodge without telling her mother she's going. She leaves a note in her sister's shoe.
Well, she knew that if she told her family what she was planning, what she wanted to do, they wouldn't not only permit it, it would be like I'm going to Mars. To leave, to relax, to not work, to spend money, to vacation. I think the word vacation itself was utterly foreign, and not just in the sense that it's an English word, just would not compute. It was a very gutsy thing to do, and it was a big risk. And when she goes away, she doesn't think about what's going to happen when she comes back. It's only on the trip back she goes, "Oh my gosh, what am I going to face?" Addie was taking a big risk, and when she comes back, she thinks, "What if they don't let me back in the house?" Which could have been the outcome, and she was taking a big risk the rest of her life.
between her, I think, reading club at the Settlement House and Rockport Lodge, this is where Addie discovers the larger world of immigrants of all national, of all origins, national origins. This is where it becomes a melting pot story here. She meets young women of many countries.
So she's friends with she's friends with other Jewish girls up there. She becomes best friends with Philomena Gallinelli and a couple, and Rose and also Irene, who are two Irish girls who have very different backstories as well. And we get a glimpse of the differences, but they're all facing similar challenges. How to be a woman in this world. One of her friends, Gussie, becomes a lawyer, and against all kinds of odds. And Philomena becomes the person she does because her parents have both passed away. And there's actually nobody who's enforcing, and she has no brothers, she only has sisters. So nobody is enforcing the kinds of rules that Italian families imposed on daughters. And she actually becomes an artist and even leaves Boston completely. And that's an even more radical and gutsy kind of change, even than Addie makes in her life. So they're remarkable people. And also some of her friends get married and have children and have very sort of, in some ways, conventional lives. And they are part of her story as well. So it's not just, in a way, Addie's story is not the extraordinary woman story. She does not become the mayor of Boston. She does not become a school principal. She ultimately gets married and raises a family. Her, what's extraordinary about her is just her personality and her perseverance. It's one of these untold, quiet stories of power and grace that that generally don't make it to the they certainly don't make it to the big screen, let's say.
I want to back up for a minute because I want to read something that you wrote. You, again, you started when you discovered Rockport Lodge. If you don't mind, I'm going to read your words to you, if you don't mind. Here's what you said about that. You said, I tracked down the Rockport Lodge archives, which are housed at the Schlesinger Library on the history of American women at Harvard University. 47 boxes filled with fundraising letters, brochures, housekeeping minutia, newspaper clippings, board meeting agendas, and scrapbooks. The scrapbooks are yellowed and brittle, scrawled with spidery signatures, inside jokes and pledges of undying friendship. But here's the part that I think is so interesting. There are also pictures of girls lined up in ankle-length skirts, girls lounging on Good Harbor Beach in daring 1920s swimsuits, girls wearing boxy shorts and bobby socks. The clothes are a fashion timeline and tell a story about profound changes in American women's lives.
I really fell in love with the clothes, I have to say. I mean, we're all watching Downton Abbey, and we all know that the clothes are the stars of that show. But watching, thinking about this period from the early part of the 20th century, when women's skirts were on the floor and were wearing corsets, and the shirt waist had you cinched in at the waist, and you were covered up to your neck and down to your hands. And then all of a sudden, the corsets were gone, the skirts got off the floor, women started wearing pants, and that's the end of a certain kind of physical confinement,
I think. Actually a very funny scene, I think, in which Addie puts on a pair of pants with Philomena. They're visiting an artist.
Yes.
And she doesn't talk about it at great length, but she does say to Philomena what an interesting experience it is to be wearing pants.
Right. It's unbelievably liberating. You can open, you can spread your legs. You can take giant steps. You can feel a kind of freedom. It gives you the opportunity to think about riding a bicycle or a horse or going sailing and not worrying about falling over a skirt. So it's a physically liberating experience that's happening at the same time that other kinds of opportunities are opening for women.
The Boston girl certainly falls in line with the body of your work. A newspaper writer said at one point about you, Diamond has built her career on taking women seriously. Is that a fair statement?
I take that as a great compliment, yes. And I think my focus is on taking women seriously who would not otherwise be taken seriously, would not be the subject of novels. So untold stories, undertold stories of women historically and in contemporary times is kind of my MO. That and the importance of women's friendships. But a character like Addie, at the beginning I thought I'd make her into some kind of a exemplar of everything, but it seemed to me that telling the story of a relatively ordinary woman who has a happy marriage, and this is, you know, there's drama and loss in this life, as there are in all of our lives, but she's not. No one's going to set up a bust of her on the lawn of Boston Common. She's not that kind of person. But she is the kind of person who has transformed the world and who is a trailblazer in some ways for her daughters and her granddaughters as well. So it's sort of the quiet history, the counter history of women.
Anita Dimit is the author of The Boston Girl. The novel tells the story of an unremarkable woman who makes her way through the vast changes which women experienced in 20th century American life. While she was in the studio, we talked to Dimit about another passion in her life, the Jewish ritual bath known as the mikveh. She founded a mikveh in Boston and talks about its meaning to her and other Jewish men and women in a web extra we've posted on our website. You can find it by going to gpb.org/TWS. That's all the time we have for this week's show. Jessica Forkel is our producer. Jonathan Reedy is our intern. I'm Bill Nigut. See you next week.